Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
Everybody who's associated with the game, who makes their living somehow off of the game, owes a big debt of gratitude to Tiger.
Tiger Woods is at Augusta. Rumors of other players on the course have been wildly exaggerated. Ahead in Only a Game, Tiger's 15-year journey from the 1997 Masters to this weekend. Also, reading about Bounty Gate is one thing. Hearing Greg Williams' motivational speech is another. We'll update the latest fallout from the Saints' pay-for-injury scheme. Also ahead, retracing Colorado's 19th century postal routes at the Elk Mountain Grand Traverse overnight ski race. And Magic and Bird finally make it to Broadway. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. As Billy Payne, the chairman of Augusta National, steadfastly ignored the opinion of the president of the United States, among others, regarding the club's refusal to admit female members, golf's most illustrious players, among others, finished their second rounds at the Masters. Jason Duffner and Fred Couples share the lead at 5 under par. Rory McIlroy and Bubba Watson are among the handful of players one stroke back. Tiger Woods is 8 shots off the pace at 3 over par. This year marks the 15th anniversary of Woods' first victory in one of golf's 4 major tournaments. His unprecedented performance in the 1997 Masters is now a dividing line in golf history. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
Forget for a moment the list of victories. Forget the red shirts on Sunday. Forget the SUV hitting the fire hydrant and the scandal. In April of 1997, Tiger Woods was 21 years old and on the rise. He'd been named the 1996 PGA Tour Rookie of the Year. But Woods' start at the Masters was ugly. New York Times reporter Bill Pennington was there.
What is sort of lost in the story is that he went out in the first 9 holes and played horrible. He shot 40 in his first 9 holes that Thursday, which is pretty much, you know, you're on your way to shooting 80 and you're done.
Then the crowd in Augusta, Georgia got their first glimpse of something more powerful than Tiger's monster drives. His focus. On the back nine, he shot 30 to finish the day 2 under par.
No one in all the rounds that have been played at the Masters before that had ever shot 40-30. It was just this amazing turnaround from a guy who, in the middle of his round, recognized what he was doing wrong and could change it.
By the end of the day, Woods was 3 strokes off the lead. By the end of his next round, he was ahead by 3. On Sunday morning, he was up by 9. A year earlier, Greg Norman squandered a large lead at Augusta National. Tiger Woods would not make that mistake. Jim Nance called the tournament for CBS.
There's no doubt in my mind he's very aware of the significance of this putt in terms of the tournament scoring record.
There it is! A win for the ages!
Woods set a Masters record with a 4-round total that put him 18 under par. He beat runner-up Tom Kite by 12 strokes, another tournament record. He was the youngest player to don the iconic green jacket. All of those marks still stand. Sports Illustrated senior writer Alan Shipnuck covered the tournament and still views it as Woods' defining performance.
To do it on that stage with the socio-political overtones of Augusta National, the wave of excitement he rode into town on and to deliver, it really is, looking back, even more incredible than we realized at the time.
The other major championships jump from venue to venue, but the Masters never leaves Augusta National, where change is rare and slow. Woods became the first player of African or Asian descent to win a major just 7 years after the club admitted its first black member. And his appeal crossed all demographics. Shipnuck says rocket launcher drives were the initial draw, but Woods provided many more.
Tiger's charisma is strictly as a performer, not as a person. The smiles, the fist pumps, the brooding intensity, all within one round or one hole even. And there was just so many factors all at once that just made him such a riveting performer.
Over the next 3.5 years, Woods would record 20 more victories, and his impact on the game began extending far beyond the fairways. Tournament television ratings climbed when he was playing well, which was pretty much all the time. Increased tour sponsorships followed. Meanwhile, with Woods as its spokesman, Nike became a player in the golf equipment business. Golf.com deputy editor David Dusek says one aspect of the sport that didn't surge along with Tiger was casual golf.
Tiger's arrival in professional golf was fantastic for his competitors. It was great for television, but we did not see the surge in participation that we anticipated seeing, and we haven't really, to this point, seen the surge in minority participation.
Expecting one man to fill up tee times across the land might have been a stretch, but filling up trophy cases was no problem. In 1999, Woods started a streak of 264 weeks as the world's top-ranked golfer. After reclaiming the spot in June 2005, he held it for another 281 weeks. Knee injuries and swing adjustments qualified as significant disruptions in Tiger's world until late 2009, when news of his numerous extramarital affairs started to come out.
It always makes a difference when you have further to fall, and I think he had further to fall.
Only a Game's Charlie Pierce profiled Woods for GQ in 1997. The story included the phenom flirting and telling off-color jokes.
There were at least a few breadcrumbs that might lead you in the right direction, that things were not always what they seem. I wouldn't take an enormous amount of credit for that, and I certainly wouldn't have anticipated his sex life would turn out to be such a, you know, Baroque public carnival as it turned out to be.
In December 2009, Woods withdrew from the PGA Tour. He returned for the Masters in 2010, but didn't earn a victory until the Arnold Palmer Invitational at Bay Hill in Orlando last month. Now Woods is one tour victory away from tying Jack Nicklaus's record of 73. But the real record to beat is Nicklaus's 18 major championships. Woods has 14. Can a Tiger beat a Golden Bear? Bill Pennington of the New York Times believes that question could end up unresolved.
I've been having this feeling for a while that he's going to end up tying him. And maybe in some ways that would be the best outcome for people that watch Jack Nicklaus play and how Jack Nicklaus has handled himself and what he means to the game. And that is a reasonable assumption, I think, for him to win four more.
By Jack Nicklaus standards, Woods has plenty of time. He's 36 years old. Nicklaus was 46 when he won his final major championship. And yes, it was the Masters. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
For 6 years, Hank Haney was the guy who was supposed to tell Tiger Woods how to improve his golf game. Maybe there have been more daunting jobs if, say, somebody was in charge of telling William Shakespeare how to write plays that would endure, or perhaps there was somebody whose job was to spot Duke Ellington's clinkers. Anyway, even the best golfers have coaches, and Hank Haney served in that capacity for Tiger Woods from 2004 until 2010, which means he was on the job when Tiger's extracurricular activities hit the headlines and he stopped winning tournaments. Hank Haney's book, The Big Miss, has just been published. Mr. Haney, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on.
You write that you were thrilled when Tiger Woods called and asked you to work with him. Why?
Well, that's the opportunity of a lifetime for any teacher, any coach, to be able to have an opportunity to work with a player the magnitude of Tiger Woods. Tiger, you know, was already the best player in the world, and to get a chance to observe and learn from his greatness and hopefully contribute to it was an opportunity that I cherished.
How long was it before you felt that he had started sending this message, and I'm quoting now from the book, "When I play bad, when I don't win, it's your fault"?
Well, I mean, that was about the second time that I got together with him. It's not that uncommon.
You concluded at one point in your relationship with Tiger Woods that, quote, "winning gave him permission to remain a flawed and in some ways immature person." It sounds like a psychologist's diagnosis. Were you at all hesitant to publish that sort of analysis?
You know, not really. I mean, these are my opinions. You know, obviously they're formed from observations and from, you know, years of coaching. But this book is largely my opinion.
You write of, and here I'm quoting again, "the insane drive that was vital to his greatness." Insane, that's pretty extreme.
You know, obviously Tiger is an incredibly gifted and great athlete and performer. Great performers, they are different. And, you know, the one thing that I observed about Tiger was that he is definitely different. He had this incredible drive. He had this determination that, you know, even though I had coached over 200 touring pros, I had never seen before. His, you know, determination and his drive, it was unlike anything I had ever seen.
Throughout his career, Tiger Woods has been surrounded by people who celebrate him and celebrate his achievements and protect him in great part from the press when he wants to be protected. Did that have anything to do with the fact that he eventually got involved in all these affairs that, of course, became public and brought him down?
Well, just in general, when people have problems, they usually have enablers that enable them to be that way. You know, I never knew that he was having these affairs. Steve Williams, his caddy, never knew. You know, the first time that I ever knew that there was even an inkling of a problem was when Tiger's agent, Mark Steinberg, called me. And this was a week or so before the whole scandal broke. And he said, there's going to be an article come out in the National Enquirer. And it's about Tiger and this girl, but it's not true. None of it's true, and everything's going to be okay. And, you know, of course, you know, a couple weeks later, he hit the fire hydrant, and, you know, it turned out to be true, and that and a lot more.
I have to say that after reading The Big Miss, it's hard not to conclude that Tiger Woods, for all his undeniable brilliance on the golf course and his charitable work and his public contention that he intends to rediscover Buddha, is an egomaniacal, spoiled, and selfish man inclined to paranoia. I don't know if that was the impression that you intended to create.
I was really just trying to tell an honest story and be as fair and honest as I could, and I feel like that's what I did. There's certainly far more positive things than negative things. I think it's up for the reader to draw their own conclusions.
At the end of the book, you express your gratitude to Tiger Woods for the insight he provided you regarding the phenomenon of greatness, is the way you put it. What's the nature of that insight?
I learned so much from being around Tiger. I mean, not just about golf, but about, you know, what it took to perform, you know, at a high level for an extended period of time. A lot of people can do things, you know, great things for a short period of time, but very few can do it over an extended period of time. At one stretch during the time when I coached him, he won 7 tournaments in a row. Another stretch, he won 6 tournaments in a row. And that's unique because most of the time, touring players that win a tournament, they have trouble the next week playing. You know, they had such a great high, and then they come down off that. I never looked at Tiger and thought, you know, well, he shouldn't be like this, or it'd be better if he was like this. I just looked at it as this is part of why he's so great. And these things that are different about him, this complex individual, explains his greatness to me in many ways.
Hank Haney is the author of The Big Miss, My Years Coaching Tiger Woods, and the book is published by Crown Archetype. Hank, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. A 1080 is a stunt in which a skateboarder sails into the air and then completes 3 revolutions before landing. That's a simple sentence, but a 1080 is not a simple stunt. In fact, nobody had completed one until 12-year-old skateboarder Tom Scar of Malibu, California, recently did so. Observed by numerous fans, one of them fortunately with a video camera, Scar came up short a few times, but only a few. He completed the 1080 on his 4th try. "I'm pretty stoked," said young Scar. "I thought it would take 3 days of trying it 40 times. I was just amazed." Listeners are advised not to try any 1080s at home, especially if they're older than 12. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the roar of the magic, the smell of the bird, or something like that. But first, on Thursday, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell met with New Orleans Saints head coach Sean Payton, Saints general manager Mickey Loomis, and assistant coach Joe Vitt, all of whom Goodell had suspended in connection with the so-called bounty hunting program that then-defensive coordinator Greg Williams, also suspended, had instituted while Peyton and Loomis were in charge of the team. Peyton, suspended for a year, Loomis for 8 games, and Vitt for 6 games, are presumed to have asked for reductions in their suspensions. Peyton also sought clarification regarding how much contact he could have with the team while serving his suspension. On the same day the commissioner heard the appeals, audio of Greg Williams addressing the Saints before their January 12th playoff game against the San Francisco 49ers became available.
We've got everything in the world to make sure we kill Frank Gore's head. We want him running sideways. We want his head sideways.
Frank Gore is a running back with the 49ers.
We're going to dominate the line of scrimmage, and we're going to kill the head. Every single one of you, before you get off the pile, affect the head. Early, affect the head. Continue, touch and hit the head.
The audio was recorded by Sean Pamphilon for a documentary he was making about a former Saints player. Greg Williams, who had left the Saints after the 2011 season to become the Rams' defensive coordinator, has been suspended indefinitely, and he has not appealed that decision. Commissioner Goodell is expected to respond soon to the appeals from Peyton, Loomis, and Vitt. He has not yet indicated when he will have anything to say about disciplining Saints players or whether he will consider a Louisiana Senate committee's resolution on Wednesday that the punishment of the team, the coaches, and the general manager was, quote, too harsh. The NHL regular season ends today when the Blackhawks play the Red Wings. Both teams will see action in the postseason, which begins on Wednesday. So we now call upon the LA Times' Helene Elliott to talk about some of the 14 other hockey teams with employees who can't play golf yet. Hi, Helene.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. The players employed by the Ducks, Blue Jackets, Stars, and 11 other non-playoff teams are probably already playing golf or hunting or fishing. Would you be happier if fewer than 16 teams qualified for postseason play?
I would, but actually the prevailing thought seems to be going the other way. There was a movement to have more teams in the playoffs, so it's like, why do you play an 82-game season then?
The New York Rangers wrapped up the East's best record on Tuesday night, and in fact, nobody won more games than the Rangers did this time around, 51. Does this mean nobody wins more playoff games either?
The correlation between the best regular season team and the best team in the playoffs isn't very strong over the years. If you take a look at it, there's always the theory that you don't want to win the President's Trophy and have the best record because that means you're expending too much energy now before it really matters. So this is a really unusual playoff season in that there's really no dominant team. I mean, the Rangers have a very good record. Vancouver has over 100 points. St. Louis has had an excellent season. But there's no team that you can look at and say, yep, they're definitely the favorites going into this.
The East has been strong this season. Without inappropriately emphasizing the excellence of the team that makes its home in the city where this program originates, tell us which Eastern teams will flourish beginning Wednesday.
You mean the defending Stanley Cup champion?
There you
Bruins?
Go.
Oh, yeah. I like the Bruins. They've had kind of an up-and-down season, but they seem to be getting things together at that point. They were getting depth scoring. They were getting scoring from their third and fourth lines. And Mr. Chara is just one of the most dominant defensemen I've seen in a long time. It could be a team that's going in with a little bit of momentum that ends up being one of the last teams standing when they're playing for Lord Stanley's chalice.
The Florida Panthers topped the Southeast Division of the Eastern Conference. I suppose somebody had to. But they finished the regular season by losing 5 games in a row. Does that matter?
I don't think so. I think it's just such a different sense. And it is really, like the cliche, a new season. I think it just becomes so different now. There's going to be, or there should be, a greater focus on defense, although the other night, watching the Kings and the San Jose Sharks score 10 goals disproves that theory.
In the West, you have to respect the Canucks, right, with 50 wins?
You do? Okay, if you say so.
Well, you're the one who's the expert in hockey. You tell me if I've got it wrong.
Yeah, you do. I mean, when the Canucks, if they're at full strength, yes, they're deep, but they've had a number of injuries this season, as they did last season. And Roberto Luongo's goaltending hasn't exactly inspired tremendous confidence lately. Again, there's no favorite in the West either. I mean, St. Louis has had an incredible season. You look at their goaltending, number one in the league. It's the two-headed goalie monster. You know, they're both so good. And it's very rare. Normally a team will have one goalie who plays a great majority of the games, and they haven't had that. They've had Halak and Elliott playing a lot of games, each of them. So it's, but it's worked out for them.
Alin, since we have reached the end of the regular season, perhaps the time has come to ask you for a favorite moment during that regular season.
Oh, there are so many. Would it be the night the clock in Staples Center gave the Kings an extra second and change and allowed them to win a game that they shouldn't have won? Could it have been the night very recently when Ryan Klo of the San Jose Sharks reached over the bench to play the puck with his stick and everyone in the building saw it except the referees? There are just so many to choose from, so many wonderful moments like that.
On a much more serious note, Brendan Shanahan, the NHL's head disciplinarian, has had one regular season now to create changes in on-ice behavior. Is he succeeding?
To a degree. I mean, some of the headshots, I'd love to see him give out 8, 10, 12 games, you know, really long punitive suspensions, and he hasn't. You know, there are some theories that maybe some of the general managers and club executives have gotten to him a little bit. I think he's done a pretty good job. I would like to see some of them tougher penalties, but it's a tough call. It really is.
Alin Elliott writes for the LA Times, and she's at her best when filing stories at 2 a.m. from motel rooms outside of Calgary, Edmonton, and Moose Jaw or Flin Flon. Alin, have you ever been to Flin Flon?
No, and I've always wanted to. I wonder if there's a Bobby Clark statue there.
Well, I think you should go up there and see and write a story about it. And in any case, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Anyone who turned on a television from the late 70s through the early 90s is familiar with the story. Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. One black, one white, one embracing the spotlight in Los Angeles, one hiding from it in Boston, both hard-working Midwesterners who became fast friends despite their rivalry on the court. Only a Game's Karen Given recently revisited the familiar tale in an unfamiliar place.
And in the role of Magic Johnson, please welcome Mr. Kevin!
It begins just like a game at the Garden. The lights go down, the music comes up, and spotlights swirl on a parquet floor.
Ladies and gentlemen, your cast of Magic Bird!
But we're 223 miles southwest of Boston, at Broadway's Longacre Theater in New York. And those aren't athletes up there, they're actors, like Peter Scolari, caught just outside the cast door a few hours later.
The music is so stirring, I guess, being an aging former, you know, just slightly above average high school athlete, there is a realization of a childhood fantasy.
That's right. Scolari, he of Bosom Buddies and the Newhart Show fame, once dreamed of becoming an athlete. Instead, he's helping to bring Magic Bird, the story of basketball's greatest rivalry, to the Longacre.
It's a story about people getting beyond themselves. It plays out in the story, the context of the story, plays out amongst the actors on stage, because four of us play 15 roles.
Scolari plays four roles, including Lakers owner Jerry Buss and legendary Celtics general manager Red Auerbach. The costume changes are made with a mustache here, a bright green Celtics jacket there, all taking place on stage and in full sight of the audience. Here, helped to life by a dangling cigar, Scolari's Auerbach and an NBA executive discuss a new television deal featuring the Celtics and the Lakers.
Maybe this will get us out of television prison.
What's that supposed to mean?
We've got to get back on primetime TV.
Oh, you're talking about
the tape delay broadcast.
Yeah, who the heck watches those?
Exactly.
Who watches television 1 o'clock in the morning?
I don't think hockey does worse.
Don't get me started on hockey!
The same production team staged Lombardi at the nearby Circle on the Square Theater last year. Critical response was, quote, tepid, according to the New York Times, but the show ran for 8 months. The reviews for Magic Bird are much better, but producer Tony Ponturo explains that the challenge was the same, satisfying longtime Broadway theatergoers.
And then you're going to have sports fans who are going to walk into the theater for the first time and say, oh, this is what a Broadway theater looks like and a play.
Larry Bird is one of those theater newbies. He reportedly told Tug Coker, the actor who plays him, the opening night will be the first time he's ever seen a play on Broadway. Or anywhere.
Irvin Johnson, 42 minutes, field goals 9 for 16, assists 12, rebounds 11.
The actors take aim at hoops which fly in from off stage while projected newspaper box scores swirl around them.
Larry Bird, 44 minutes, 12 for 18 shoot, 11 assists, 14 rebounds.
Guys eating me alive.
The staging is novel, but the idea that the two players kept an eye on each other's stats is nothing new. Bird described doing just that for a 2010 HBO documentary. In fact, one theatergoer described the play as, quote, identical to that movie. It's a bit of an overstatement, but Ponturo says even though the plot is familiar, the setting, an intimate space where cell phones and other distractions are forbidden, adds something new.
It is the one time that we're sort of, you know, told to put our swords down, be quiet, listen, and just take in the storytelling in the theater.
Vince Lombardi died 40 years before his story hit Broadway, but while the actors work out a few kinks on stage, Ponturo admits he's a little worried about how this opening night's VIPs will react.
There's a scene in the 1984 finals where Magic did not shoot in a game two when there was time expiring, and we basically say Magic choked. You know, so now he's read the script.
You don't basically say it. You say it.
Well, we say it. Yeah, well, yeah, we say it quite dramatically, actually. And you do cringe at times that they're not going to run after you after the performance and say, what were you thinking?
ESPN's Jackie McMullen, who chronicled the rivalry in her book, When the Game Was Ours, and served as a consultant on this play, isn't concerned.
Magic Johnson's been on stage his whole life. To him, this is nothing different. I think he loves this idea. I'm sure he'll try to push it forward to something else beyond that. He's the one that always wants to do these things and has to talk Larry into them.
Larry Bird played his entire career in Boston. Magic Johnson did the same in L.A. But New Yorkers filled the theater during previews, and many said they'd recommend that their sons and neighbors and co-workers come back after opening day. McMullen says that's the power of this rivalry.
You know, there are a few tandems that have the kind of reaction that Larry and Magic do. I would say that Frazier and Ali were one, Martina and Chrissy were probably another, but there's only a handful.
Magic and Bird brought new fans to the NBA at a time when the league was floundering. Broadway could use a boost today, and McMullen says sports could provide it.
When Lombardi came out, the entire New England Patriots team went to see it. And I can't think of another play that the entire New England Patriots team would go see. So I think they're onto something here.
The show's producers envision a series of sports-related offerings, but they're not ready to talk about what's next just yet. First, they have to get through opening night of Magic Bird on Wednesday with Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and Jackie McMullen in the audience. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You're listening to Only a Game. In days of old, Major League Baseball's playoffs involved two teams playing in the World Series. To reach it, you had to win the American League pennant or the National League pennant. But over the years, MLB's playoffs, like the playoffs of the other leagues, have expanded, and this season they will expand again. Besides the six division winners, those playoffs will include not just one, but two wildcard teams from each league. After a one-game playoff in each league, the two winning wildcard teams will advance to the postseason's next round. Jeff Luhnow, general manager of the Houston Astros, approves of the change.
From our standpoint, we're looking forward to being competitive and being able to challenge for a playoff spot. I think the only drawback is that first round for those last two teams becomes all or nothing in a very short series. And I think that's going to be a challenge for the team that gets bounced in that first round. But anything that keeps more markets involved, I think is going to be good.
Jeff Luhnow is not alone in that conclusion.
You know, I ultimately am supportive of it.
Mark Shapiro is the president of the Cleveland Indians.
I think at the level of engaging another market for a longer period of time, I think is a positive. In addition to that, I think it rewards the division winners in a way that haven't been rewarded in the past.
Mark Shapiro's conclusion is based on the fact that none of the division winners would face a short playoff series against a team that had failed to win its division. And according to Rob Nyer, the national baseball editor for the website SB Nation, the new format would have yet another benefit.
I think the one-game playoffs are going to be really fantastically exciting baseball. We've had one-game playoffs going back to the 1940s, one-game playoff for the pennant in those days, and for the most part, all of the playoffs, whether it was a one-game series or for a while in the National League best of three series, have been incredibly exciting. We're going to have those every year now, something like those.
This is not to suggest there are no arguments against the new system. There are. Some fans have objected because the fifth best team in one league or the other could end up winning the World Series, which, they suggest, further devalues the regular season in the interests of generating more money for the owners. Others have worried that more late fall games means more potential postponements and perhaps the distraction of baseball while they're trying to get ready for Thanksgiving. The 2012 season has already gone into the record books for providing the longest ever opening day game, in which it took the Blue Jays 16 innings to beat the Indians. This fall, we'll see how the most crowded postseason in baseball's long history works out. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
There are numbers of reasons to take up boxing, self-defense, for example, and aerobic exercise, and then there's fundraising. That was the idea when Father Dave Smith, an Anglican priest, stepped into the ring with an invitation to all comers. On Sunday, Father Smith, who was 50 years old, boxed an astonishing 123-minute rounds, thereby raising $10,000 for the Youth Center at Holy Trinity Church in Dulwich Hills, Sydney, Australia. The six continuous hours of boxing also garnered for Father Smith a world record for continuous boxing rounds, something the lads in Dulwich Hill should perhaps keep in mind when they're told they'd better not skip church. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. A chilly, if not excessively snowy, overnight ski from Crested Butte to Aspen. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
The problem with having a Crested Butte is you can never wear a hat.
Yeah, it's true. And you need all that gel to
keep
it
right.
Up. Yeah. The Major League Baseball season began on Wednesday night, unless it began on Thursday afternoon or a little over a week ago in Japan. Can Commissioner Bud really have screwed up the idea of opening day that thoroughly?
No, what are you talking about? He's given us four opening days.
I don't want four. I want one symbolic,
he gave us
important
four
opening day.
Days on two continents. It's a new Major League Baseball record.
I'll have to grant you that. It's never too early for a record in the baseball season. And we got another one. Tell me how the Toronto Blue Jays distinguished themselves in Cleveland this week.
This surprised me in that I never gave this much thought. But the Blue Jays beat the Indians 7-4 in what is the longest opening day game ever, 16 innings. J.P. Arencibia was the, you know, won the game. He had a three-run homer 5 hours after the first pitch to give the Jays a 7-4 lead. If the Jays are really going to put on a move in the American League East, they've certainly gotten everyone's attention at this point.
Among those who missed opening day, whenever it was Colorado Rockies pitcher Josh Outman, who was on the injured reserve list. A sore arm?
Unfortunately, he ate something bad. What happens when you eat something bad, Bill, is you start throwing up.
That'll happen.
And the problem is if you eat something really bad, you throw up really hard and you can hurt yourself. And that's what happened. He strained his oblique. And I'm pardon me if you're listening to this shortly after breakfast.
We shouldn't laugh because he's out.
I've had food poisoning. It is no laughing matter, believe me.
Tuesday night saw the women's basketball team from Baylor complete the first 40-0 season in NCAA history by virtue of scheduling one more game than previous undefeated teams. The score in the final was 80-61. Any reason why Baylor shouldn't be 80-0 next April?
No, not really, as long as Brittany Griner doesn't, you know, sprain an ankle or go to a monastery or something.
Or eat something that doesn't agree
exactly,
with her.
Exactly, or eat something that doesn't agree with her. She's going to be the Lou Alcindor / Kareem Abdul-Jabbar of women's basketball by the time she's done. And I noticed, by the way, that they just happened to conveniently leave one spot open on the United States Olympic women's team. And I'll bet it's a really tall spot in the photo. You know, it's one of the ones in the back row.
On the men's side, of course, Kentucky was the winner, which circumstance caused a joyful celebration in Lexington, and no problem there, right?
Well, except for Harold Calloway, who got shot in the leg. No, everybody was fine. This is described, of course, by the AP as a raucous street celebration. It's always, I think you have to call it that when someone's getting clipped.
Now that he's finally coached a champion, John Calipari said this week, and I'm quoting, "Kentucky is the best job in basketball coaching. Why would I leave?" So are the New York Knicks likely to provide him with a sufficient number of reasons featuring the likenesses of various former presidents?
I honestly don't know if he'll take it, but I don't see any way the Knicks don't offer him the job.
Anthony Davis, who's a freshman at Kentucky, intends to leave the campus for the NBA. League Commissioner David Stern would like to see a new draft eligibility rule that would prevent Mr. Davis from doing that, and he's got an unlikely ally.
Yes, he's got Mark Cuban. David Stern wants you to have to wait 2 years after you get out of high school before you can join his league. Mark Cuban wants you to wait 3 years until you get out of high school. First of all, none of these things are legal. The first kid whose unofficial agent can find a smart lawyer is going to get this rule overturned. One and done is a terrible rule, but the only real option is none and done.
Everybody knows that coaches in the NBA have no job security, Charlie. This week it became apparent that Orlando Magic coach Stan Van Gundy is being undermined by the team's star Dwight Howard, and I bet Stan Van Gundy was angry when that story was leaked. Who leaked it?
He did, actually, and God bless him for it. He finally got fed up with Dwight Howard, as I think any reasonable soul in Orlando would get fed up with Dwight Howard in this place. And, you know, I don't have any problems with locker room stuff becoming public because I'd be a hypocrite if I had any problem with it. And second of all, I don't have a problem with coaches defending themselves, although I do think it's an indication that Dwight Howard's going to get his wish at the end of the season.
Earlier in this program, we heard audio of former New Orleans Saints defensive coordinator Greg Williams urging his players to, quote, kill the bleeping head in general and indicating some specific heads that he wanted killed. The audio was released as Sean Payton and the Saints appealed the penalties that had been levied for their involvement in Williams' misdeeds. Not the best timing, I suppose.
No, Roger Goodell is going to uphold his penalties, and I think Greg Williams' indefinite suspension has become incredibly more indefinite over the last week.
For high school football players, it's the season for visiting coaches on college campuses. How'd that go for a carload of Houston-area players headed for Texas Tech?
Well, let's face it. First of all, Lubbock is a really hard place to find, but it is in West Texas. So if you get in your car and you drive to East Texas, you're going the wrong way. If you go to East Texas instead of West Texas, you lose.
They almost made it to New Orleans.
But yes, imagine the coach at Tulane surprise when three top 50 recruits show up.
Hey, guys.
Actually, Devin Lauderdale, who apparently was the mastermind behind this expedition, said, "We didn't use a GPS, so we didn't know we were going the wrong way." Devin, the sun! Follow the sun! People without clothes and shoes used to be able to go west instead of east.
And finally, Charlie, I'm going to leave it to you to salute a basketball player named Mohamed El Akari, who must be really tired.
Yeah, he plays in the Lebanese Division A, and they were in the Final Eight of their league championships. And Mr. El Akari, hit for 113. The box score line, and my good friend Bob Ryan is a connoisseur of these things. He had 113 points. He was 32 for 59 on three-point shots, and he was 40 for 69 overall. He had 113 points. He had one free throw. Go to the basket, Muhammad, at least once.
You can't tell this man anything about how to play basketball.
He just scored 113. Go to the basket.
Charlie Pierce, who's writing about sports, appears in Grantland, among other places, joins me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Only a Game's new Facebook timeline has allowed us to post some, well, how should I say this, vintage photos. Only a Game made its debut in 1993, and now you can see original promotional photos for the show and pictures of staff members who've come and gone over the years. Plus, there are shots of the current Only a Game team in action. And every week we share interesting links, photos, and discussions about sports. Like us at facebook.com/onlyagameradio. That's facebook.com/onlyagameradio. The Major League Soccer season is off to a start that has delighted one of the league's most accomplished foreign players and dismayed another of them. Thierry Henry, who starred for Arsenal and FC Barcelona before turning 32 and joining the New York Red Bulls in 2010, was named Player of the Week twice and then, not surprisingly, Player of the Month for March, during which he scored twice against Colorado and then three times against Montreal. But the far more thoroughly celebrated David Beckham, who has now played longer for the LA Galaxy than he did for Real Madrid, though not as long as he did for Manchester United, is reportedly disgruntled. The rest of the league was expected to move aside for the defending champion Galaxy this season, but LA has stumbled out of the gate, losing twice in three games. Beckham was removed at halftime during the loss to New England. I'm sure he's not pleased about it, L.A. coach Bruce Arena said, but who knows? Perhaps the early exit enabled one of the world's most energetic product endorsers to refresh himself at a local fast food emporium.
Can I get one of those new strawberry and banana smoothies?
What did you say?
Hi, beautiful. May I please have a strawberry banana smoothie?
Though Beckham has rarely been removed from a game early unless he's been injured or he's kicked somebody with malice aforethought, he's said to be healthy these days, and no wonder as he's added those no doubt nutritious fruit drinks to his diet. He and the Galaxy will have an opportunity to begin turning their season around this afternoon against the undefeated Sporting Kansas City. Thierry Henry will attempt to augment his league-leading total of 5 goals when New York faces the Crew in Columbus. In the late 19th century, a pocket of remote Colorado high country buzzed with the rush for gold and silver. The bust that followed left resilient settlers in places like Crested Butte and Aspen, where winter solitude was a way of life. The only link to the outside was a group of skiing postmen who carried supplies, letters, and hope. Today, to celebrate that legacy, there's the Elk Mountain Grand Traverse, a 40-mile backcountry ski race from Crested Butte to Aspen. Jason Albert attended the 2012 edition, and he has this report.
Listen for a moment. It's the same sound heard in these mountains for generations, the kick and glide of skis.
In the early days, we had a couple of guys who were legendary postmen.
That's Wayne Vanderbush, a local skier and history professor.
Man, one guy named Al Johnson from Crystal, deep in the mountains. And this guy would carry the mail once a week from Crystal to Crested Butte and then back on skis. And he went through some of the worst avalanche country in the world, practically.
Deep snows and epic journeys were part of life. For some, that's still true today. The Grand Traverse is a 40-mile ski race over terrain similar to what Al Johnson endured. In a conference room in the Grand Ballroom at Mount Crested Butte, crowds of sinewy skiers have their gear checked by race organizers. First-time participants Brad Bergdorf and Matt Madsen empty their packs. Their assortment of warm clothing, spare ski parts, and food resembles a yard sale. Racers participate in teams of two and carry loads of mandatory equipment. Race volunteer Tally Morrison carefully examines the gear they're required to have.
You need minimum of 100 ounces of water, a headlamp. Each of you has to have a headlamp, and we have to have a spare headlamp.
That's the spare,
okay. Sunglasses, goggles, and sunscreen.
During the race, whiteout conditions are often a possibility, so race organizers preach self-sufficiency. Skiers must carry gear to navigate avalanche terrain and survive the night out. Former Grand Traverse winner Brian Wickenhauser knows anything's possible on the steep slopes.
If it's not the gear, it's the weather. And if it's not the weather, it's looking inward in yourself. Did I train hard enough this year? Did my partner train hard enough this year? Who, you know, there's so many variables involved. And that's what's so fun, is just the allure of trying to run a clean race, so to speak, and have everything dialed.
It's nearly 11 p.m. Moments before the start, organizers ensure each racer's avalanche beacon functions.
Number?
I think it's 101.
It is 101. All right. Good. Number? 55.
Some are here simply to finish. They're tweaking packs, second-guessing. Others stretch in Lycra speed suits, fasten carbon fiber boots. At the base of Crested Butte Mountain Resort, skiers line up, music pumps. It's festive, like an alpine Mardi Gras. Skiers await Father Tim Clark's blessing of the skiers.
All right, you guys ready for a little dose of the Holy Ghost?
Woo! Hearken, ye Nordic warriors, to this blessing now in verse. For the quest that you share will require all your hearts.
Skis anxiously slide back and forth.
Now give a great cheer for this great Grand Traverse race!
The headlamps from 150 teams glow like a singular mass, illuminating the snow. The racers speed away and crest the first of many hills. It's been a dry winter, so along with a few miles of dirt trail, skiers encounter creek crossings. At the higher altitudes, they must endure Star and Taylor passes. Then it's 10 difficult miles of rolling terrain. And with the freeze-thaw cycle here in full swing, the snowpack is bulletproof at the start. The next morning, 33 miles into the race, I'm at the Barnard Hut. All racers remain here for a mandatory 10-minute medical check.
141. Did you get 141 parts?
Yep. Welcome to the Barnard Hut.
Have you got 141 parts?
I see Matt and Brad, the team from the gear check. They're sipping warm ramen, smiling, and soaking up sunshine. Matt says it's been tougher than it appears.
It's been a struggle at points. There's been points where we've really been good and really just going with it, and then there's been points where either both of us are struggling.
Among his problems are blisters and a spell of low blood sugar midway through the race. Despite that, he's been doing well.
And then right here, this hill, I ate it at the top, and I actually ejected out of my skis, and they ran the entire hill all the way down.
For others like Adam Farrow, it seems Star Pass, perhaps the steepest, most exposed descent on the route, made the legs shaky.
Yeah, I didn't realize how steep Star Pass was, and then I, you know, kind of peered over. I was like, it's going to be scary. So, and I ended up just hiking down most, or a lot of it, or like that head wall at least.
Adam's soon racing off. It's mid-morning, sunny and warming. The snow's slushy and it's slow going. From here, it's a grinding 7 miles to the top of Aspen Mountain. Atop the ski area, racers ski a sloppy 3,000-foot groom run to the finish. It turns out race winners Brian Wickenhauser and Brian Smith finished at dawn in a record time of 7 hours, 32 minutes.
Oh, and now, here we go into the finish.
By late afternoon, teams still struggle in. but they're all greeted like winners. Matt and Brad finish in 13 hours and 47 minutes. They're not planning to rent gear next year. Patrick O'Neill, a member of the second place team, is a school teacher from Crested Butte. He says the Grand Traverse is part of the communal fabric.
And seeing people finish like a father-daughter team, and seeing people, like people will say, wow, that's amazing you did it in that time. I'm watching people who have been out on their skis for 15 hours. They're the champs. People who have done it to think about somebody they just lost to cancer. And there's all of these things taking place that just make it a true community event. It's a classic, an absolute classic.
O'Neill's humility speaks to the race's core, that some people make the best of their place in the world. It's been like this here since the skiing mail carriers. Snow and the rugged landscapes between two points on a map are a calling. For Only a Game, I'm Jason Albert.
Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Conlin. We had help this week from Amanda Art. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Jason Albert's Grand Traverse pictures or Karen Given's Magic Bird photo gallery, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from Grand Traverse volunteer Tally Morrison.
Map. You need a map.
Really? You need a map for a little 40-mile ski race conducted partially in the dark? I guess. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.